A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. Hummus is to the chickpea what Wonder Bread is to wheat. A single flattened expression of a profoundly versatile ingredient. He wants to know how long humans have been eating chickpeas, where they rank among legumes today, and what else you can actually do with them beyond the obvious dip. And honestly, I've been thinking about this. Most people's relationship with chickpeas begins and ends with a tub of Sabra. That's like saying you know Beethoven because you've heard the first four notes of the Fifth Symphony.
I'm Herman Poppleberry, and this is My Weird Prompts. And corn, that analogy is almost physically painful to me as someone who has spent way too much time thinking about legume phylogeny. But you're right. The chickpea has been domesticated for 10,000 years. It has fed empires. It has traveled from Neolithic Anatolia to the streets of Nice and the markets of Gujarat. And we've reduced it to a beige paste in a plastic tub.
Beige paste in a plastic tub. There's your album title.
Before we get to the recipes, we need to understand how this humble legume went from Neolithic fields to your grocery store shelf. There are three threads here. The deep archaeological history, which is genuinely fascinating and goes back to the very dawn of farming. The current global footprint, where chickpeas are quietly the second most consumed legume on Earth. And the culinary diversity that most people completely miss. I want to give all three their due.
For the record, I've been saying for years that chickpeas are underrated. I'm pretty sure sloths invented chickpea flour.
You have never said that once.
I'm saying it now. It's an ancestral practice.
Let's start at the very beginning. 10,000 years ago, in the hills of what is now southeastern Turkey and northern Syria. This is the pre-pottery Neolithic B period, roughly 9,500 years before the Common Era. The earliest known chickpea remains come from a site called Tel el-Kerk in Syria, and chickpeas were not a standalone discovery. They were part of what archaeologists call the founder crop package.
Founder crop package? Sounds like a subscription box for ancient farmers.
It kind of was. The package included einkorn wheat, emmer wheat, barley, lentils, peas, bitter vetch, flax, and chickpeas. These eight crops were domesticated more or less simultaneously in the Fertile Crescent. They were the agricultural starter kit for human civilization.
Chickpeas were there at the founding of agriculture. Same meeting as wheat and barley. That's a pretty good pedigree.
And here's where the genetics get interesting. The domesticated chickpea, Cicer arietinum, has a wild progenitor called Cicer reticulatum. A group of researchers led by Eric von Wetberd published a major genetic study in 2018 that showed something alarming. Modern Kabuli chickpeas, the large beige ones you see in every grocery store, have only about 20% of the genetic diversity of that wild ancestor.
So we took this robust wild plant and turned it into the legume equivalent of a purebred dog that can't breathe properly.
That's exactly the concern. It's called a domestication bottleneck. When early farmers selected for specific traits, bigger seeds, thinner seed coats, non-shattering pods that don't burst open before harvest, they inadvertently stripped out most of the genetic variation, which means modern chickpeas are sitting ducks for disease. A single aggressive fungal pathogen could devastate the global crop because there's not enough genetic diversity to find resistant individuals.
This happened 10,000 years ago, and we're still living with the consequences.
And it's actually getting more urgent because climate change is expanding the range of pathogens like Ascochyta blight, which is already the biggest disease threat to chickpea production globally. Plant breeders are now racing to reintroduce resistance genes from wild Cir reticulatum, but it's slow work. You're essentially trying to put genetic diversity back into a crop that lost it millennia ago.
The chickpea's origin story is also a cautionary tale about monoculture. Before monoculture was even a word. All right, so they domesticated it in the Fertile Crescent. How did it get everywhere else?
The spread is well documented archaeologically. By 2,000 years before the Common Era, chickpeas show up in Bronze Age Greece, specifically at the site of Tiryns. They appear in ancient Egyptian texts, though interestingly they were less common than lentils or fava beans in the Nile Valley. The Egyptians seem to have preferred their other legumes.
Picky eaters. the pharaohs.
The Romans, however, loved chickpeas, and this is where we get one of my favorite historical food facts. The oldest surviving Roman cookbook, Apicius's De Re Coquinaria, from the 4th or 5th century of the Common Era, includes a recipe for chickpeas cooked with leeks, honey, and vinegar. It's essentially a savory sweet Roman dish. Leeks and honey.
Leeks and honey. I'd try that, though it sounds like something you'd eat and then immediately need a nap. Which, for me, is most meals.
The Roman name for chickpea was Cicer. That's where we get the genus name Cicer, and there's a famous Roman anecdote. The orator Cicero got his cognomen, his family nickname, from an ancestor who supposedly had a chickpea-shaped wart on his nose. Cicero means chickpea.
One of Rome's greatest orators was literally named after a legume because his great-grandfather had a weird nose. I love that. That's the kind of historical detail that makes me want to keep doing this podcast.
During the Islamic Golden Age, chickpeas spread further across the Middle East and North Africa. Medieval Arab cookbooks from the 10th and 13th centuries include chickpeas in dishes like hiss, which is a meat and grain porridge. And there are early versions of what we might recognize as falafel, though the modern falafel with fava beans or chickpeas is a later development. There's actually a scholarly debate about whether falafel originated in Egypt with fava beans and then migrated to the Levant with chickpeas, or the other way around.
The falafel origin wars. I've seen those get heated.
In 16th century Europe, chickpeas were called cicer, and were a peasant staple, often roasted and eaten like nuts. Street vendors in Spain and Italy sold roasted chickpeas the way vendors today sell roasted chestnuts. The Spanish then brought chickpeas to the Americas in the 1500s, where they became part of Latin American cuisine, particularly in Mexico and the Andes.
The real explosion in chickpea diversity, I'm guessing, happened in South Asia.
And this connects to a misconception we should address. Most people think of chickpeas as a Middle Eastern ingredient. In reality, India produces and consumes about 70% of the world's chickpeas. South Asian cuisine has by far the most diverse chickpea repertoire on Earth.
The hummus industrial complex has colonized our mental image of a crop that's actually dominated by India. That's almost poetic.
The key moment was the 19th century invention of mechanical milling. Before that, chickpea flour, which is called besan or gram flour, was labor-intensive to produce. Once milling became cheap and industrial, besan exploded across British India. That drove the creation of pakoras, bhajis, dokla, the sweet laddu, an entire universe of chickpea flour foods that most Westerners have never encountered.
That's still the case today. Walk into an American grocery store, you'll find hummus in 12 flavors. You will not find dokla.
Let's talk about the types, because this matters for both history and cooking. There are two main varieties of chickpea. Dizi, which are small, dark, rough-coated, mostly grown in South Asia and Ethiopia. And kabuli, which are larger, beige, smooth-coated, dominant in the Mediterranean and the Americas. The name kabuli literally means from Kabul, suggesting the route through which these larger chickpeas reach the Middle East and Europe.
Dizi is the original, and kabuli is the prettier cousin who moved to the city and got famous.
That's not inaccurate. Dizi chickpeas have a nuttier flavor and hold their shape better in curries. Kabuli chickpeas are creamier when mashed, which is why they're preferred for hummus. And here's something most people don't realize. The chickpea flour you buy in stores is typically made from Dizi chickpeas that have been split and hulled. Those are called chana dal and then ground. That process gives a finer texture and lighter color than grinding whole kabuli chickpeas.
The flour in your pantry and the chickpeas in your curry are technically different varieties, even if the label just says chickpeas. That's useful to know.
Now let's jump forward to the 21st century. In 2014, a French vegan chef named Joël Rossel made a discovery that changed plant-based cooking. He found that the liquid from a can of chickpeas, the stuff everyone had been pouring down the drain for decades, could be whipped into a stable meringue-like foam.
Which is just a fancy Latin way of saying bean water.
Bean water that revolutionized vegan baking. The proteins and starches in chickpea brine mimic the functionality of egg whites. You can whip it into stiff peaks, fold it into mousses, use it in macarons, even make mayonnaise. 3 tablespoons of aquafaba replaces 1 egg white. It's a 10,000-year-old ingredient yielding a culinary innovation in the last decade.
That's what gets me about the chickpea. Every era finds something new to do with it. Neolithic farmers boiled it. Romans braised it with honey. Indians made it into flour and fermented it into steam cakes. And 21st century vegans turned the wastewater into meringue. The thing just keeps giving.
That's the ancient history. But what about today? How does the chickpea stack up against other legumes? And what are people actually doing with it?
Before you dive into the numbers, I want to flag something about hummus history. You mentioned earlier that the modern version isn't ancient. What's the actual timeline?
The earliest known recipes that resemble hummus appear in medieval Arab cookbooks from the 13th century. But they used vinegar and herbs, not tahini. The modern hummus by Tahina, chickpeas with tahini, lemon, and garlic, is a much later standardization, probably 19th or early 20th century. It became widespread in the Levant and then went global in the late 20th century. So when people say hummus is an ancient food eaten for thousands of years, they're conflating the chickpea with the dip. The dip is relatively modern.
The dip is modern. The legume is ancient. Another misconception bites the dust. All right, give me the numbers.
According to the Food and Agriculture Organization's 2024 data, global chickpea production hit 18 million tons in 2025. That's a 40% increase since 2010. Chickpeas are now the second most consumed legume globally by volume, behind only dry beans, Phaseolus vulgaris, which includes black beans, pinto beans, kidney beans, and so on.
That's higher than I would have guessed.
It surprises people. Soybeans are higher in total production, but most of the global soybean crop goes to animal feed and oil production. For direct human consumption, chickpeas edge out soybeans. Lentils are fourth. India alone produces and consumes roughly 70% of the world's chickpeas. Australia is the second largest producer and the largest exporter, shipping mostly to India, Bangladesh, and the Middle East.
The hummus market specifically?
Grandview Research valued the global hummus market at $3.2 billion in 2025, growing at about 10.5% compound annual growth rate. That sounds huge, and it is, but it represents only about 15% of total chickpea consumption. The other 85% goes to whole chickpeas and curries, chickpea flour and snacks and sweets, roasted chickpeas eaten as snacks, and a small fraction to animal feed.
The hummus industrial complex, despite its cultural dominance, is actually a minority shareholder in the chickpea economy. That's a useful corrective.
Let me take you on a tour of what the other 85% looks like, and I want to start in Punjab. Chana masala is probably the most famous chickpea curry in the world. It uses whole kabuli chickpeas simmered in a spiced tomato and onion gravy with amchur, dried mango powder for sourness, and garam masala for warmth. It's a breakfast food in parts of North India, served with bhatura, a puffy fried bread. The chickpeas are cooked until they're tender but still hold their shape. That's the desi versus kabuli thing in practice. Desi chickpeas are actually better for chana masala because they don't disintegrate.
Chana masala for breakfast. I respect a culture that starts the day with spiced chickpeas.
Now let's go to the Ligurian coast. Sakka, also called farinata, is a chickpea flour pancake from Nice, Genoa. The batter is just chickpea flour, water, olive oil, and salt. It's poured into a large copper pan and baked in a wood-fired oven at extremely high heat, around 450 degrees Celsius. The result is a thin, crispy-edged, creamy-centered flatbread that gets cut into irregular wedges and eaten hot, often with nothing more than black pepper and a drizzle of olive oil.
450 degrees. That's pizza oven territory.
And the copper pan is essential. Copper conducts heat so efficiently that it creates a specific texture you can't replicate in cast iron. Sakka is street food. You walk up to a window in the old town of Nice, they hand you a paper cone of hot sakka. You eat it standing up. It costs a couple of euros. It's been made this way for centuries.
Two ingredients plus water and salt. That's the kind of recipe that only works when the technique is perfect. There's nowhere to hide.
From Gujarat, we get dokla. This is a fermented chickpea flour cake that's steamed, not baked. You make a batter of besan, yogurt, and water, let it ferment overnight, then steam it in a flat dish. Once it's cooked, you temper it by pouring hot oil infused with mustard seeds, curry leaves, and green chilies over the top. The result is fluffy, tangy, savory, and studded with crunchy seeds. It's eaten as a snack, a breakfast, or a light meal.
Fermented and steamed. That's a completely different texture profile from everything else we've talked about. The chickpea flour is doing something totally different there.
The fermentation develops a slight sourness, and the steaming keeps it incredibly light. It's almost sponge-like. And the tempering at the end, that hot oil hitting the mustard seeds so they pop, that's where the flavor comes from. It's a technique that's completely foreign to most Western cooking, but central to South Asian cuisine.
What about Sicily? You mentioned penne earlier.
Penne are chickpea flour fritters from Palermo. You cook chickpea flour with water and salt into a thick polenta-like paste, spread it onto a flat surface to cool and set, then cut it into rectangles and fry them until golden. They're often served in a bread roll, like a sandwich, sometimes with ricotta or lemon wedges. They're crispy on the outside, creamy on the inside, and they cost basically nothing to make.
A chickpea flour sandwich. That's the kind of carbohydrate-on-carbohydrate action I can get behind.
It's been street food in Sicily for hundreds of years. The Spanish connection is probably how chickpeas reached Sicily in the first place, given that Sicily was under Spanish rule for centuries.
Let's talk about snacks.
This is a Turkish snack that dates back to the Ottoman Empire. Whole chickpeas are roasted until they're crunchy, then seasoned with salt, spices, or sometimes sugar. They're sold by street vendors in paper cones, eaten like nuts. In Turkey, there are entire shops dedicated to leblebi, with different roasts and seasonings. It's the kind of snack that's been around so long nobody thinks to export it.
Which is why most people outside Turkey have never heard of it. The chickpeas problem isn't a lack of uses, it's a lack of marketing.
I want to mention one more thing before we move on. This is a relatively new product. South River Miso in Massachusetts first commercialized it in 2018. Traditional miso is made from soybeans fermented with koji, a mold called Aspergillus oryzae. Chickpea miso substitutes chickpeas for soybeans, and the result is sweeter and less salty than traditional miso. It's become popular in the kind of high-end kitchens that are always looking for a new ingredient to play with.
So now the chickpea has conquered the fermentation world too. What's next, chickpea cheese?
Actually, there are companies working on chickpea-based cheese alternatives, but that's probably a different episode.
Let's talk about chickpea flour more broadly. You mentioned baizan has about 22% protein. That's nearly double wheat flour.
And that's why it's become a staple in gluten-free baking. The problem is the flavor. Chickpea flour tastes distinctly beany, which limits how much you can substitute in a recipe. Most gluten-free blends cap chickpea flour at about 30% of total flour weight. Above that, your chocolate chip cookies start tasting like falafel.
Which is either a bug or a feature, depending on your palate.
The technical reason is interesting. Wheat flour forms gluten networks when you add water and knead. Those networks trap gas during fermentation and baking, giving bread its structure and chew. Chickpea flour has no gluten. Its proteins are mostly globulins and albumins, which don't form networks. So, chickpea flour batters and doughs rely on starch gelatinization for structure instead. That's why Sokka works. You pour a thin batter into a screaming hot pan, the starch gelatinizes instantly, and you get a structure that holds together without any gluten.
The physics of chickpea flour are completely different from wheat flour. You can't just swap one for the other and expect it to work. You have to design the recipe around chickpea flour's properties.
And that's why traditional chickpea flour dishes from around the world are so instructive. Sokka, dokla, penne, pakoras. These are all recipes developed over centuries that work with chickpea flour's specific rheology, its flow and deformation behavior. They don't try to make chickpea flour pretend to be wheat flour.
There's a word I didn't expect in a food episode. But it makes sense. The way chickpea flour behaves when you mix it with water determines what you can make with it.
It explains why chickpea flour pasta, for example, is tricky. Without gluten, the dough doesn't have the extensibility to roll thin without breaking. You have to add xanthan gum or another binder. Or you make a different shape entirely. There's a Sardinian pasta called fregola that's essentially chickpea flour, and water rolled into small pearls and toasted. It works because the shape doesn't require gluten strength.
Let's talk sustainability. You mentioned chickpeas fix nitrogen.
Chickpeas are legumes, and like all legumes, they form symbiotic relationships with rhizobia bacteria in their root nodules. These bacteria convert atmospheric nitrogen into a form plants can use. Chickpeas fix about 40 to 60 kilograms of nitrogen per hectare per growing season. That nitrogen stays in the soil after harvest, reducing the need for synthetic fertilizer for the next crop. It's why chickpeas are a key rotation crop in dryland farming systems from Australia to Saskatchewan.
The water footprint?
About half that of wheat per gram of protein. Chickpeas are drought-tolerant. Their deep taproots can access water that shallow-rooted crops can't reach. That's one reason they've been a staple in semi-arid regions for millennia. You can grow chickpeas in places where wheat would fail.
Which makes them strategically important as growing zones shift. If the Mediterranean gets drier, chickpeas might become more important, not less.
That's exactly where the forward-looking research is focused. There are active chickpea breeding programs in Saskatchewan, Canada, and in Norfolk in the UK, trying to develop varieties that can handle shorter growing seasons and cooler temperatures. The goal is to expand chickpea cultivation into northern latitudes as climate change reshuffles agricultural zones.
The genetic bottleneck you mentioned earlier makes that harder.
When you're trying to breed for new traits, cold tolerance, disease resistance, drought tolerance, you need genetic diversity to work with. If your entire breeding population is drawn from that narrow 20% slice of the wild gene pool, you're severely limited. That's why seed banks and wild relative conservation are so important. The genes that might save the chickpea crop 50 years from now might only exist in a wild Cicer reticulatum plant growing on a hillside in southeastern Turkey.
The future of the chickpea depends on protecting its wild ancestors. That's a nice full circle argument for conservation.
Let me give you some practical takeaways. We've covered a lot of ground, from Neolithic domestication to Sicilian street food.
Distill it for the person who's just realized. Their chickpea horizons end at the hummus tub.
First, seek out chickpea flour. It's sold as besan or gram flour in Indian groceries and increasingly in mainstream supermarkets. Try three specific recipes. Soka, which is the easiest. Just chickpea flour, water, olive oil, salt, and a very hot oven. It takes 10 minutes and two ingredients. Dokla, which requires fermentation and steaming, so it's a weekend project, but the result is unlike anything in Western cuisine. And if you can find chickpea miso, try it in salad dressings or soups. It's a completely different flavor profile from soy miso.
The Desi versus Kabuli distinction?
That's the second takeaway. If you're making a curry where you want the chickpeas to hold their shape and have a nutty bite, find Desi chickpeas. They're smaller, darker, and you'll probably need to go to an Indian grocery to find them. Most American supermarkets only carry kabuli. Kabuli are better for hummus and for salads where you want a creamy texture. Knowing which variety to use for which dish is a small thing that makes a real difference. Aquafaba is not just for vegan meringues. 3 tablespoons replaces 1 egg white. You can use it to make mayonnaise, chocolate mousse, even as a binder in veggie burgers. The liquid from 1 standard 15-ounce can of chickpeas yields about 1/2 cup of aquafaba, which is equivalent to about 3 egg whites. Don't throw it away. It's liquid gold.
Liquid gold that you've been pouring down the drain your entire adult life.
The broader point is this. The chickpea's 10,000-year history is a story of constant reinvention. Every culture that encountered it found new things to do with it. The Romans braised it. The Gujaratis fermented and steamed it. The Sicilians fried it. The Turks roasted it. The French made it into street pancakes. And 21st century vegans turned the cooking water into foam. The hummus era is just the latest chapter. It's not the whole book.
Where does the chickpea go from here? Let's look ahead.
The first is climate adaptation. As growing zones shift, can chickpeas move into northern latitudes? The early trials in Saskatchewan and Norfolk are promising, but the genetic bottleneck is the limiting factor. We need the wild relatives. The second frontier is protein isolates. Companies like InnovoPro in Israel and Chickpea, also in Israel, are developing chickpea protein concentrates that rival soy and pea protein for use in plant-based meat alternatives. Chickpea protein has better taste than pea protein, which can be bitter, and better functionality than soy protein for certain applications. If this scales, chickpeas could become the protein backbone of the alt meat industry.
The chickpea might end up feeding not just the hummus eaters and the curry eaters, but the people buying plant-based burgers in 2030.
That's the thing about this crop. It has survived empires, famines, culinary trends, and 10 millennia of agricultural upheaval. It will probably outlast hummus, too.
The chickpea abides.
It really does.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
The Greek explorer Pytheas, writing around 320 before the Common Era, described an island called Thule, located 6 days' sail north of Britain. For centuries, scholars and cartographers placed Thule on maps as a real landmass, variously identified as Iceland, Norway, or the Shetland Islands. But Pythias's description of a place where the sun never set in summer and sea turned to a jelly-like substance suggests he may have encountered sea ice and the midnight sun somewhere near the Arctic Circle, not a specific island. Thule was a misinterpreted observation of Arctic phenomena, not a lost landmass.
Sea turned to jelly. That's one way to describe slushy ice when you've never seen it before.
This has been My Weird Props. Our producer is Hilbert Flumingtop. If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review wherever you listen. It helps other people find the show. Until next time.
Try the soccer.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Props, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.